Well, good morning, Faith Community. How are you this morning? My name is Tim Porter. I'm one of the pastors here for Faith Community. If this is one of your first times here, thank you for being here this morning. I know that there are other places where you can invest your time, and I think you've chosen a good day to be here today. We are in the beginning of a new series and a letter called The Romans, a letter to the Romans, and we just started it last week. This letter was written by an early follower of Jesus, and it's written to a church that Paul, the author, never met. And this letter is written to a church in Rome, and that's why it's called To the Romans. And this letter is all about God's good news, all about God's good news. The good news about God's grace that changes absolutely everything. Everything when we get a hold of it. It changes absolutely everything. This letter to the Romans, again, is written by a man named Paul, and Paul was once a persecutor of the church, and he hated and he despised Jesus. But then, after Jesus' resurrection, Jesus appeared to this Paul. You can read about it in Acts 9. There he goes by his Hebrew name, Saul. And Jesus showed Paul great mercy and forgiveness, and Paul's life was absolutely transformed by this encounter with the risen Jesus. And Jesus appointed this Paul to be a key leader in the first century movement of Christianity. And so in this letter to the Romans, we learn from a man who lives and breathes the gospel. And so you and I can learn to live and breathe the gospel, because that's what he's teaching us all about, to live and breathe the gospel. Now, we use the word gospel around here a lot at Faith Community. Every church should. What is the gospel? What does the word gospel mean? Well, we looked at this last week, and you can review any of our sermons on our website. You can podcast them. But what we looked at last week is the gospel means, just by definition, it's the good news. It's the good news, the announcing of God's good news. Today, we move into a section beginning in verse 18, chapter 1, verse 18, that goes all the way actually to chapter 3, verse 20. We're not going to cover all that today. But this section of the letter to the Romans is about the bad news. We prize and delight in the good news because the bad news is the backdrop for the good news. Today we begin looking at a section that's focused on diagnosing our problems as humans from God's perspective. And this passage, this section, is probably one of the most piercing, insightful, and depressing texts on what is actually wrong with the world that I've ever read. I think possibly that's ever been written. When we look at the world, we all know, we ourselves know that all things are not the way they're supposed to be. Racism, it's wrong. Stealing, theft, embezzlement, wrong. Gossip, wrong. Murder, wrong. Death, terrible. And the wrongs of our world are so big, one of the questions comes to us is why? Why are they wrong? Why are there these wrongs? But also, what can be done about them? Is there anything that can be done about the wrongs in this world? And the gospel's answer is yes, 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 the wrongs can be righted. But, as we all know, as good engineers will tell us, if you want to fix the problem, you got to get to the core of the problem. And how you define the problem shapes the solution that you come up with. And so God's given us a solution. What's the problem that he sees, that he's going after to fix? That's what we're going to begin looking at today. The core of our problem is not a behavior problem. It's not an education problem. It's not a limited resource problem. At the core of what has gone wrong in this world is a worship problem. A worship problem. So if you don't have a Bible, I highly recommend grabbing one of the ones in the chairs in front of you in the rack, and we're going to turn to Romans 1:18, and we're going to read through verse 32. It's found on page 939 in the Bibles in front of you. If you don't own a Bible, if you've never read a Bible, the big numbers are the chapters, the small numbers, the superscript numbers are the verses, and page 939 in the Bibles in front of you. If you don't own a Bible, again, feel free to take that one that you have in your hands and take it with you and read it. And we will fill the chairs with more in the future if you take those. But you got to promise to read it. We'll find out. No, just kidding. Romans 1:18 through 32. And just so you know, too, we're starting something new, a new practice as a church. How many people tried to memorize Romans 1:16 through 17 this last week? Oh, great. Well done. Good. Anybody want to try? No, just kidding. I said we weren't going to do that, right? But this week, the memory verses are the first two verses, Romans 1:18 through 19. And you should have cards that you got from the ushers as well that you can continue to memorize these verses as we go through the book of Romans. Romans 1:18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who, by their unrighteousness, suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for the images resembling mortal men, man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore God gave them up to the lusts of their heart, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. Because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and serve the creature rather than the creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. For their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not be done. They were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, and malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, and maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice that. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, if I do my job well this morning, we will find ourselves trapped in a place that we can't get out of, and then we'll have a surprise ending. That's where we're going. But let's begin here. We are made to worship our Creator. The Bible is clear from the beginning to the end that we, as creatures, are made to worship God. And there are at least three reasons for this. First is God is magnificently and awesomely beautiful. Our God is unimaginably immense, for he created all things and holds all things by the span of his hand. Simply because of who God is, simply because of who he is, he deserves worship. Now, as a family, I don't know if you're like this as a family, but as a family, when we see beautiful things in creation, we want to direct everybody else's attention to them. Even when my wife and I are apart, even when I'm in India and she's back in the States, look at the moon, we'll text. Look at the moon. And then we respond back, wow, the moon is so beautiful tonight. This beauty in creation, as you see the beauty in and of itself, just inherent beauty, it calls forth something from within us to acknowledge it and to exclaim it. If creation's that beautiful, how much more the God who made it all? Simply because of who he is, we are made to worship his inherent beauty and acknowledge him and worship him. Another reason is that he is due worship from us. He's due worship from us because we're his creation and he is the creator and our sustainer. As children, all of us in here are children of somebody. As children, we owe honor to our parents because they cared for us. They helped us to survive. They clothed us, fed us. We were at one point in time, and some of you still are, dependent on our parents. And we are alive today in some measure because of our parents, because of their help. Even more than when we should we owe God our worship and our honor, because everything that we have is from him. That song that we sang, it's your breath in our lungs. You gave us the breath. And so all we're doing is giving that breath back to you in praise because you are the giver and sustainer of all things. One other reason, creation itself, that's one of the key messages of this passage. Creation itself is made to point us to God and to worship him. Paul is very concerned to help us see that creation is a witness to us. Every human being is a witness that we are made by God and to worship him. Paul says in verse 20, his invisible attributes, namely God's eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. When we look at creation, we should think there is a mighty, eternal God who made and sustains all this. That's what creation's for. One author put the point well, it seems. The visible things of this world point to an invisible creator who possesses eternal power and a divine nature. And human beings have been wired up. It's part of our design features to know him and to believe in him so that we, when we observe nature, nature is the theater of God's glory. It's God's beauty and glory on display. What this text goes on to say is that we instinctively know something about God from the things that he has made. A friend of mine, a New Testament scholar, a commentator on Romans, wrote this: God has stitched into the fabric of the human mind his greatness so that they are, that is, his eternal power and his nature are instinctively recognized when we view God's world. We are made to worship our Creator. So, what does worship mean? We use the word worship around here a lot, and one of the things we're doing here is we're in a worship service, a worship gathering. What is worship? Well, at certain parts of the Bible, worship is described as a gathering to sing together and pray to God, definitely. And this is, might be our default definition of what worship is. But the biblical definition of worship is actually far broader, and we can see some of the all-encompassing nature of worship by how Paul describes what we as humans have not done. So I want to look at the negative, what Paul says we haven't done as humans in relationship to God, to see what we are supposed to do. What is worship? What is it? Honor and thanksgiving. Honor and thanksgiving. These are dispositions of the heart, that our heart is engaged in worship, that we have a sense of honor to God, to glorify God. And it means at the core of our being, our heart, the very core, believes and feels that God is the most important and most beautiful being in all existence. We're to give thanks continually. There's never supposed to be a time in our lives where we're not giving thanks to God. To have a constant awareness of all good things come from God. A constant awareness. We're to serve. Serving is a part of worship as well. It's how we live our lives. How we live our lives, what we do, and what we do with the things that we've been given. With our bodies and with our resources. To worship by service is to live God's ways in all aspects of our lives, our sexuality, our finances, our time, our relationships. Everything we are and have is given to us to serve God and his purposes. We are stewards of the good gifts that God has given to us. That's how we see ourselves. I was just repenting during the second song. God, so often I think of my things as my things. Everything's a gift. Hold everything with an open hand. Lastly, we're to acknowledge God. And acknowledgement is more than just simply a quick statement of, oh yeah, God's great, and going about our business. Rather, when you look at the Bible, acknowledgement is to say that God is of such importance. God is of such importance that we unceasingly think about and consider him and how everything is related to him. He's that important that he's our constant thought. What do you dream about? Do you dream about God? Do you daydream about God? That's what daydreaming's for. That's what it means to worship, putting it all together. Our hearts are made to always delight in and feel the awesome importance of God. We are to live with a continual thanksgiving to God, and all who we are and all that we have is to be done in the way that God prescribes and commands, and not in the ways that he prohibits. This is the purpose for which you and I are made. This is what it means to glorify and worship God. And I don't know if you felt convicted at all during that description, but I did. Nobody does this. Not in its all-encompassing way and not in its consistency and constancy. Nobody lives like this. Something has gone terribly wrong. What has gone wrong? This is where it gets hard. To our ruin as human beings, we exchange worship of Creator for the creation. We choose to worship creation instead of the Creator. This is the core of what's wrong with us and human history, and it's the solution toward which God has acted. At the core of what's wrong is that we choose to worship created things rather than our Creator. Paul even adds a little phrase here about who is worthy forever. Amen. On our own, left to ourselves, without God intervening in some way, you and I, our heart disposition is that you and I, we will always, 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 always choose creation over Creator. There's no way out. Why do we turn to the creation instead of the Creator? Paul uses three phrases to describe this. The Bible's view is that everybody knows that there's such a thing as a Creator, an eternal and Creator God. And so why doesn't everybody follow this God? Why is it that not everyone acknowledges this God? Well, Paul says this. First is that you and I, our hearts, are characterized by suppressing the truth. You know, a few weeks ago, if you were here at Easter, I talked about Tom Cruise and Jack Nicholson, right? And you can't handle the truth. There's a sense in which that is exactly true. Our human hearts don't want the truth. Suppress them. Suppress the truth. I think this is a universal experience. I don't know. But I'll describe what I've done in the past, and that is, or in times I'm still tempted to do, and times I still do. That is, you want to do something wrong. And you know you want to do something wrong. And you know it's wrong. But you want to do it. And so what do? How do you help yourself do yourself something wrong? You suppress the truth and do it really quickly, right? Well, if I do it quickly, then I can at least do it and get it over with, and then, oh, well, I'll deal with the consequences later. But I'm done debating. I'm done being tempted. I'm just going to take that last drink, or I'm just going to take that last cookie, or I'm just going to take that money, or I'm just going to watch that, or I'm just going to do this. I'm just going to do it quickly and get it over with. That's suppressing the truth. You know it's wrong. I know it's wrong. I want to do it, even though I know it's wrong, even though it's going to be painful afterward. And I suppress the truth and do it. That's what it looks like to suppress the truth. Our hearts continually do that. What we do with an accurate not exhausted, but with an accurate view of God's eternal power and his holiness that we get from creation is that we suppress that truth. We don't let that truth lead us to God. We let it, we suppress it. Paul says that we're also futile in our thinking. God has given us, I mean, just amazing, wonderful reasoning capacities. There are some absolutely brilliant people at Faith Community. We've got people doing some amazing things in business. It's astounding. And what Paul says is that you and I use our reasoning capabilities not to draw us to God, but to reason our way away from God. That's what we use our reasoning capabilities for. Lastly, we have darkened hearts. This means that our hearts don't desire the right things in the right proportion. We desire good things way too much, or we desire to do things that are actually going to be destructive to us. Our hearts are dark. Has anyone ever been to the Crystal Cave over in Spring Valley area? Or been on a cave tour? We've been in two as a family. We went Crystal Cave, and then we've been in Cave of the Winds out in Colorado Springs, just up in the foothills there. And there's been a spot in each of these tours, if I remember correctly, I might be conflating them, but I think there's a spot in each of these tours where you're in a spot where you're in the middle of the cave, and the guide says, nobody move, because we're going to turn out the lights. And they don't want you to move because you're going to fall and you can't see anything. So they turn out the lights and you experience absolute darkness. Absolute darkness. And they're going to say is that, if you experience this for a really long time, eventually you're going to lose your sight and all that kind of stuff. That's what our hearts are like. Our hearts are like that deep darkness that you get in a cave when the lights go out. And if you stay that way long enough, you cannot see anymore. That's what Paul says. Our hearts are dark. They're dark like that. And so please, we've probably all done this at some point in time, but after today, never, ever, ever do it again. One of the worst things that we can tell somebody, if this is true, is follow your heart. Disney is unhelpful. Just follow your heart. Why? Because our hearts betray us. Our hearts are this dark. What do we do as humans? What we humans do now is that at the core of our problems in this world is that we exchange, because of these reasons, the suppressing of truth and our futile thinking, and because our hearts are dark, we exchange the truth of God. We exchange worship of God for worship of creation. That's why we do it. What does that mean? You and I, left to ourselves, we will choose idols. We will choose created things. Now, back in the ancient world, when Paul is writing this letter, especially to Rome, there were temples to all kinds of idols and gods and goddesses around and on the street corners. And there was a whole economic system based in idolatry in the first century. Other parts of the world, if you were to travel to other parts of the world, it's like that as well. There's idols on every corner. But just because we don't have idols on every corner doesn't mean that we're not worshiping creation. Everybody worships something. It's part of our hardwiring. It's our design feature to worship. And so if we're not worshiping God, we're worshiping something else. This is one of the reasons why I called the sermon the Gospel for the Irreligious. Because even if you think you're not religious, don't for a moment think you're not worshiping something. The Bible really, at the end of the day, has no view of an atheist. An atheist, an agnostic, you're still worshiping something. Everybody worships. One atheist postmodern novelist writes this. He speaks better than he knows, it seems. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. You will never feel like you have enough. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. Again, when time and age start to show, you will die a million deaths before they finally grieve you. Worship power, and you will end up feeling weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to numb you to your own fears. Worship your intellect, being as smart as you can be, and being seen as smart, and you will end up feeling absolutely stupid. Oh, man. A fraud, always on the verge of being found out. But the insidious thing about all these forms of worship is they're unconscious, our default settings. Now, do we add to our problem? Okay, we're just going to get one step farther down. To add to our problem, God is not sitting idly by while we exchange the worship of the true Creator for created things. God is not sitting idly by. He loves his creation, and he loves us, and he is angry. And right now, Paul says, his wrath is being revealed from heaven against human idolatry. And that wrath is actually our ruin. Paul says in verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all unrighteousness of men." As we read about God's wrath in this passage, please remember that God's wrath is not meant in some kind of disproportionate or implacable fit of blind rage where God just sort of loses it because his creation is doing a bunch of naughty things. God's wrath is measured, proportionate, a response of his holiness toward moral evil. It's God's righteous indignation, his rage even, against those who undermine his reign and gratify the most debasing desires, who seek to abuse the most vulnerable of people. And in the sentence, we read that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven right now. I was asked on the way in, "So I'm wondering if you're going to answer my question today." I was like, "Well, what question is it? How is God's wrath being revealed today?" I said, "I will answer that." God's wrath is described, actually. God's wrath is described three times in this passage. It just so happens I've got 3, 3, 3, 3. I didn't plan it that way, just so you know. But it's thrice. It's thrice repeated. There's a phrase that's repeated three times in verse 24, 26, and 28. And it's this phrase, "God gave them up." That's God's wrath in this passage. God gave them up. God's wrath is shown right now in human history from the first act of rebellion by Adam and Eve until the last act of rebellion before Jesus returns. God's wrath is shown in that he gives us what we want. One of the most terrifying things can be to not delight yourself in the Lord, and God gives you the desires of your heart. We exchange the worship of the true God for created things, and God responds. He actively responds by giving us what we most desire. And this leads to, in the passage, it leads to impurity, it leads to dishonor, and it leads to ruin of our relationships. I've talked about this in other places, and please go to our website, and you can hear some of my sermons where I talk about same-sex attraction. And please, we've got a tab on our website as well on special events, and we hosted a faith forum a couple years ago called The Gospel and Same-Sex Attraction with a woman named Rosaria Butterfield. And more needs to be said, and that's why I want to direct you to our website, but I do need to say a couple things here about what Paul says in verses 26 and 27 about women exchanging natural relations for unnatural one, and men for exchanging natural relations for unnatural ones. And I want to say a few things here before we close out. Paul, in bringing up homoerotic behavior in this passage, he's not just picking on homosexual behavior here. He sees actually that the worship exchange that you and I do in worshiping the creation over the Creator is played out in homoerotic behavior. An exchange of the natural way of things for the unnatural. We are designed to worship God and to choose, and we choose instead to worship creation. What Paul sees is that there's a specific form of relationship where you choose, instead of the natural relationship of heterosexual sexual relationships, we exchange it for homoerotic ones. That's why he's bringing it up here in this passage. Now, for those of you brothers and sisters in Christ who experience same-sex attraction, you are in the midst of a massive battle, and I'm going to say things that you already know all too well. Our culture is telling you to do what feels natural, to embrace what you feel as your identity. Your heart, as we know, can tell you to do the same thing. And then the scriptures forbid it. And then the church hasn't done a great job either of helping those brothers and sisters who have same-sex attraction to walk in purity. But please, you don't have to battle alone in these things. We're not made to do that. I want to ask you, if you would, to take a risk and to talk to an elder, talk to a pastor, talk to a missional community leader about your same-sex attraction and ask them to help you and ask your community to help you walk in purity. It's a battle. And faith community, remember, even if you don't experience same-sex attraction, at the core of it, we're all the same in this sense. That this passage is not about same-sex attraction. This passage is about how every human being is born seeking to turn away from the living God and to worship creation. One of the more powerful things that Rosaria talks about, she was in a committed monogamous relationship with another woman when God started to draw her to himself. And one of the phrases that she'll say is, she says, "I was not converted out of lesbianism. I was converted out of unbelief." At her core, at our core, is a dysfunctional worship. And quite frankly, everybody here, all of our worship problems, our worship core, has so shaped us that there's not a person in this room that hasn't experienced some kind of sexual sin, whether in thought or in deed. We're all locked up. Not only does it lead to impurity and to dishonor, it also leads to a ruin of our relationships. Just want to glance at this, but it's important to see. Paul ends out this section, verses 29 through 30, with a list of certain kinds of behaviors that are God giving us over to our idolatry, and they ruin relationships. Notice covetousness and malice, verses 29 through 30, they are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. That means meanness and hostility. They are gossips, slanderers, verse 30, haters of God, insolent. That means rude, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents. Children, do you know at the core of your disobedience to your parents is actually a worship problem? You've exchanged the worship of the Creator and you're worshiping yourself. You're making yourself the center of attention. When we gossip, we are making ourselves the center of attention. We're trying to tear others down. When our relationship with God is broken, every other relationship suffers. And no other relationship is actually going to be fully and finally repaired until our relationship with God is ultimately restored. How do we get out of this downward cycle? How do we get out? Left to ourselves, we worship creation rather than our Creator. In response to this, God has given us over to our desires, and so we have all kinds of layers of guilt and shame and disobedience stacked on top of our core problem of worship, so that our relationships are ruined and polluted and destroyed. The point of the passage, actually, quite frankly, is that there's nothing that we can do. There's nothing we can do about it. But what we can't do, God has actually done. There's something that God has done. This is why the good news is so amazingly good news. Out of his great mercy, because of his love for us, God has made a way for us to get out of this mess. And it's all wrapped up in this word, again, gave over. Gave over. In the passage, gave over is God's wrath right now being revealed from heaven. Gave over is not only, though, gave over, that phrase, gave over, is not only about God giving us over to our things that we love and things that we cherish aside from him, it is also the solution to God's wrath. What I mean by that is this. If you read later on in Romans, eventually you're going to get to a passage called Romans 8:32. Have your ear attuned to the phrase, gave. He, that's God, who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. How will he not also graciously give us all things? What does Paul mean by that? Paul wants us to see, the Bible wants us to see, that God not only gives us over to the things that we worship aside from him for wrath, but also he gave up his son. He gave over his son to make a way for us to be restored to relationship with him. Jesus is the one who soaks up and absorbs all the wrath that we deserve because God gave him up for us. We exchange worship of the Creator for the creation, and God exchanges the wrath on us to put it on his son. He gave him up. He gave him up for us. Jesus was given up. He was ruined for us so that we could be restored. That's how we look at the cross. Jesus was ruined for us so that we can be restored. Though we are bent to exchange creation or worship for the Creator for the creation, God again exchanged his son and put him in our place. The good news is that God satisfies his own justice and he placates his own wrath by expunging our sin, drawing its deadly consequences away from us and placing them on his son. And then you and I are treated by God as if we were perfect worshipers, because Jesus gets our record of idolatrous worship on himself, and he pays for that, and we get Jesus' perfect record of worship, and we're treated that way, and we're brought back into right relationship with God who made us. When we see Jesus being ruined for our restoration, we acknowledge God, we honor him, we thank him, we praise him. We worship him. We're continually thinking about him. How could this God do this? Who is like this God? And when we're tempted to go back to created things, we remember, has a created thing ever given up their son so that I could live? And remember, if God did not spare his own son, but he gave him up for us all, how will he not also with us graciously give us all things we need? We have no reason to turn to anything else, but only to turn to the living God. In this meal that we celebrate together, communion, Jesus uses a phrase, and he says about the bread, that the bread represents his body that is given up for us all, given up for us. He gives it to us. And so in this meal, we remember what God has done and that he's given his son and that Jesus voluntarily, willingly sacrificed himself for us, swallowing up the wrath that we justly deserve so that we can get the perfect record and we can get the relationship that Jesus deserves with God. Sovereign God, I thank you for your mercy, your goodness, and your kindness, and I ask that you would cause our hearts to worship here now this morning, to honor you and glorify you. Thank you, God, for your goodness and your grace. Thank you that Jesus was given up in our place. Thank you.